Chapter 1 May 2000 When they found him, he was halfway down the only stretch of asphalt that cuts through Mercury Valley. The two police officers saw him up the road, ragged as a crow. He looked at them blankly when they pulled up next to him, neither surprised nor grateful. They asked him questions that seemed to confuse him, and his gaze slipped past them to scout the desert. He didn't struggle when they frisked him. They opened his wallet and counted out $23 in change. They read his name and address aloud to him, but his expression registered nothing. The man before them in a filthy suit bore almost no resemblance to the bright, focused face on the New York State license. Sun had darkened his features, and dust had worn itself into the creases of his skin so that it was impossible to believe he was only 36. They assumed he'd stolen the wallet, and though it was clear he was dehydrated and confused, they locked his wrists together as they led him into the car. He sat rigidly in the back seat, at a forward tilt with his eyes fixed on the road. They called him Samson, not because they believed it was really his name, but because they could think of nothing else to call him. While they treated him in the emergency room in Las Vegas for whatever he was suffering, one of the police officers put in a call for a search on Samson Green, date of birth 1/29/64. When it was discovered that Samson Green had been missing for 8 days, last seen walking out of the gates of Columbia University and down Broadway into the clear afternoon, things began to get interesting. Someone in the 24th precinct in Manhattan was able to connect the police officer to the social services agency where Samson's wife worked, and after speaking to 3 people, he was finally put through to her. "Hello," she said quietly into the phone, already informed of who was on the other end. "Is he alive?" There was a short, confused discussion. What did he mean they weren't sure if it was him? Didn't his license say Samson Green? To which the police officer didn't want to reply. "Lady, Samson Green could be lying in a ditch somewhere outside Vegas, having taken a knife to the chest from the man who's now a card-carrying member of the West Side Racket Club, the Faculty of English at Columbia University, the Museum of Modern Art." "Are there any distinguishing marks?" the police officer asked. "Yes," she said, "a long scar down the back of his left arm." She paused, as if Samson were lying in front of her, and she was inspecting his body. "And a birthmark above his shoulder blade." The police officer said he would call her back as soon as he knew anything, giving her the number of the payphone out of courtesy. She insisted on waiting on the line, so he left the receiver hanging off the hook while he went to check whether it was, in fact, her husband on the gurney. A nurse passing by picked it up and said, "Hello? Hello?" When no one answered, she hung up. A minute later, the phone rang, but no one was around, so it just rang and rang in urgent bursts, each ring separated by a brief, desperate silence. Later, they were able to reconstruct most of his journey from the receipts for bus tickets in his pockets, from the few accounts of witnesses who recalled having seen him, a waitress, the manager of a motel in Dayton, Ohio, confirmed by the ghostly flicker of his image caught by the wandering eye of security cameras. When they eventually played these tapes back to Samson, he smiled and shook his head because he could not remember where he'd been or why he'd gone there. In a way that she couldn't explain, alone in her own sadness, those images made Anna Green want her husband terribly, as she hadn't since they began to share a bed, a car, a dog, a bathroom. In one of them, the only one in which you could see Samson's face clearly, he was standing at the checkout desk in a budget motel outside Nashville. He was holding open his wallet, and his face was tilted upward, his expression as peaceful and absorbed as a child's. While Anna was looking down from the plane on the rucked mass of Nevada, cut by a glinting vein leading to Vegas, the neurologist, a Dr. Tanner, was studying a CAT scan of Samson's brain. By the time Anna arrived at the hospital, disheveled, wheeling behind her a small suitcase, none of whose contents she could remember packing, Samson had been diagnosed with a tumor that all of those months, lost in work or sleep, had been applying its arbitrary, pernicious pressure on his brain. The heat during the drive from the airport had been, even in May, almost unbearable. Now Anna was shivering in the air-conditioned hospital, her damp shirt clinging to her back. She couldn't understand, nor was anyone yet able to explain to her, how Samson had gotten to where they'd found him, some nowhere in Nevada. It was with great difficulty that she registered the words of Dr. Tanner, who was sitting across from her now. "It's about the size of a cherry, pressing on the temporal lobe of his brain, most likely a juvenile pilocytic astrocytoma." And in her own mind, clear, unthreatened by disease, Anna imagined the shiny dark red of a cherry nestled into the gray matter of the brain. Once, 5 or 6 years ago, they had pulled off the road in Connecticut to follow a painted sign that said cherry picking. They'd driven back through the early summer evening with 2 baskets and stained fingers, the windows open to let in the smell of cut grass. As she listened to Dr. Tanner's voice and his patient, kind pauses, Anna sensed he was a happy man, one who would drive home in his soundproof car listening to classical FM, to his wife with her bright and easy laugh, a man who did not wake each day to the misery he'd left slumped in the chair the night before. She felt envious of him, envious of the nurses passing in the hall who were happy enough to dress themselves this morning in starched uniforms, envious of the orderlies and the janitor pushing his gray mop along the linoleum floor. Dr. Tanner continued. "After the surgery, we'll perform a biopsy and hope it's benign," he said, a word Anna thought that seemed unkind as all euphemisms are, and as Samson had once pointed out to her. Dr. Tanner turned the CAT scan around and slid it across the desk to her, leaning forward in his chair to trace the atlas of Samson's brain with the cap of his pen. It came to rest on a yellow island in a continent of blue. He seems, for the moment, to be operating on a kind of autopilot, an awareness educated enough to get him across the country alone. Whether or not some or all of his memory functions have been destroyed permanently, or whether the surgery will itself incur such damage, is impossible to predict. Anna looked out the window to the hospital's landscape, kept evergreen by the steady dose of water meted out by sprinklers. She was 31 years old. She had been with Samson for almost 10 years. She thought of the time he'd had a toothache so severe he'd cried, and also, inexplicably, of the time he'd sent her flowers for her birthday, but on the wrong day. She turned back to Dr. Tanner and studied his face. "If you remove it, and it's benign," she finally said, "is there a chance I'll be all right?" Though by all right, what she meant was the same. "I don't think you understand," Dr. Tanner said, his voice filled with the compassion that is sometimes confused with pity. "Chances are his memory will be obliterated." He paused, a deep medical pause, his fingers resting lightly on Samson's brain. "He probably won't remember who you are."